On Blues Radio International, we're here with Derek Trucks and Susan Tedeschi. I'm very pleased to have you here this afternoon at the Blues Music Awards. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for taking time to make this possible.
I wanted to ask you something about how you ended up in the blues. And Susan, I mean, you've got a voice that is good for so many different genres of music. How did you choose?
Well, the blues, you know, is a very emotional music, and it's something that I think everybody, depending on, doesn't matter really what you do for a living, I think everybody relates to it because it's everyday music. It's things that deal with real issues, you know, whether you're a parent or whether you're trying to pay the bills or whether, you know, you're in a relationship, you know, it's things that people can relate to. It's always been very moving to me, soulful, you know, on a soulful level and a spiritual level. It's very close to gospel music. So I feel like I just really connected with it. And I just love, you know, the pentatonic scale as well as just a lot of the traditional artists that influenced me.
Who were the major influences when you started down this road?
It's been many different roads that I've kind of traveled, but I'd say a lot of the main influences are people like Mahalia Jackson and Etta James and Coco Taylor and Big Mama Thornton. And for men, you know, in the blues world, it would be Otis Rush and B.B. King and Albert King and Freddie King, anyone named King pretty much. And a lot of artists like Muddy Waters and Jimmy Rogers and Little Walter, Sonny Boy. But there's been so many influences, it's really hard to just pick a couple, you know, but I'd definitely had a few records that I wore out, you know, Big Mama Thornton, Hound Dog record on Peacock. That was a big record for me. Coco Taylor, I Got What It Takes. And of course, Aretha Franklin, a lot of her records. She actually has a record where she does all blues records, blues songs, sort of like Dinah Washington covers, and really great record. But there's a huge influence also from my dad, who played me a lot of Mississippi John Hurt and Lightnin' Hopkins as a child. So there's a nice mix of blues in there.
I was going to ask where it came from. We just talked to Vance in Funderburg earlier, and he said that a neighbor gave him a box of 45s.
Oh, wow. My father.
That's great. And so, Derek, how did you end up with blues as a focus?
You know, it's similar. I mean, growing up in the Deep South, and a lot of the music that was just going on even then, I mean, even in the mid late '80s, there was still a pretty healthy blues scene. And growing up around the Allman Brothers camp, you know, you always listening to Live at the Fillmore, listening to some of those records. You know, you hear Statesboro Blues, somebody gives you a Blind Willie version of it, and then you hear where it came from, and then you listen to, you know, who influenced your idol, who influenced Dwayne, and you listen to interviews of him talking about Little Walter or even Elmore James, and, you know, those are the records spinning in my house, too. So it was Elmore and BB, and you know, anytime you're moved by music, you jump all in, and you want to know where it came from and where it started. And anybody that's been influenced by electric rock and roll, especially the early stuff, there's a direct line right back to where we're sitting now, whether it's Memphis or just this whole area and all the music that came out of it. So I think any musician that's really worth his salt, You follow those trails. You know, if you're a jazz musician, you go back to the same handful of musicians, and if you're a blues or a rock musician, you go back to the architects of it. And you know, all roads lead back to Robert Johnson and Elmore, and, you know, all of the heavies, Sun House and the whole crew. So you know, we all get there different ways, but it's you all end up at the same place if you're paying attention.
You do, but what's interesting for both of you is you've established yourselves in other genres. I mean, Susan play many different things over the years. If I listen to your earlier work, and Derek could have played jazz fusion for the rest of your life and been happy. How come the turn toward blues?
You know, I think. For me, it's the storytelling. It's the just getting back to the basics and just the kind of back to square one. I think, I mean, when I listen to my favorite blues artists in those original recordings. You know, they were playing, it was a genre of music, and they were surrounded by certain individuals, but they were just playing their lives. I mean, they were just playing, it's just the honesty of it. And I think, you know, growing up 50, 60, 70 years later in a different place and a different time, you have to be honest with yourself, and you have to play what's happening to you, and you have to play your life. It's. I mean, you can photocopy old music and try to resurrect it, but it's just not going to be the same. And I really believe if Howlin' Wolf and some of those guys were, if they started 20 years later, the sound would have been entirely different. It would have been just as powerful. But I feel like that's what we're trying to do, is you try to get to the root of whatever it is you're doing. And for me, it happens to sound really close to some of that stuff. So, you're digging and you're trying to find it. And you get influenced by a lot of things along the way, but you end up realizing you are who you are.
I listen to you both together. I hear you both singing, one with instrument, one with voice. How did you find that synergy? Because this is really a situation where you take one fantastic performer, another fantastic performer, and one equals three or four here.
Cool.
How did you discover that?
You know, it was some common influences, you know, like Mahalia Jackson or Aretha. I mean, there was a long time where I avoided listening to any guitar players, except for some of the early guys, but it was all vocalists and horn players. And, you know, you're trying to sing to your instrument. You're trying to find melodies and less about the instrument and riffing and more about music. And when I met Susan, I was very much in that mindset. So getting to play on stage with somebody that could actually sing the way I would play if I could was inspiring. So I think we ended up musically bouncing ideas off of each other without really even knowing it, you know, just pushing each other. And so it was a nice time. We met at a great point in both of our lives musically. So I think that was a part of it for sure.
Yeah, I think Derek's right on the money too about a lot of our early influences are very similar. I also loved Elmore James and Howlin' Wolf and artists like that he mentioned. And one of the thing about all those artists that I find they have in common is when they are really in the height of what they're doing, it is so powerful and moving. You're trying to not necessarily emulate what they do, but you're trying to emulate that energy and that tone and that pureness. Yeah. And you're trying to find that within your own voice. And how can you get to the purest point? Yeah. And that's probably why Derek isn't necessarily a jazz musician, but he is. I mean, he can fit into that genre. You know, he can play with the greats, but I think for him, it's about finding, you know, that pure sound and the most powerful, the thing that's going to move people the most.
And we've all had those moments where you hear something for the first time. Like, I remember the first time hearing Howlin' Wolf, it stops time. It actually stops time. You're like, it changes the way you think about things. And we've all had those moments, and that's kind of what you go for. On a good night, that's what you're hoping to do for at least one person in the audience. You want to have those just kind of out-of-body moments. And you know, I've had quite a few musically, listening, sometimes playing, but oftentimes just listening to other people. Even, you know, it can be a record that was cut 100 years ago, and it can have that same effect. That's the beauty of music, though. It really is. It's one of those things that you can't predict when it's going to happen, and you can listen to the same recording 50 times, and there's going to be a few where it just hits you differently. And it's it really is intangible. You can't necessarily hold it. It's kind of here and gone, but it certainly changes your perspective on things.
Mm-hmm. Many of our listeners in the 88 countries we know that we have listeners in haven't heard blues music as we know it per se until they've heard us. And mm-hmm. listening to you, many of them hear things other than 12-bar blues progressions that mm-hmm. others have brought forward. You really have combined other elements of people talk about world music, but you actually have created it. What were the influences outside of the people that you've told us about that brought you to that?
You know, it really, I mean, it's a lot of the traditional musics around the world, whether it's Indian classical or Qawwali music or African rhythms. And it was just, you know, you hear things and it moves you in the same place. I remember reading, there's a great Robert Palmer book, deep blues, and just, I mean, he's tracing back certain musical styles and instruments in the Delta to the original tribes in Africa where it came from. And I remember I was listening to a lot of Indian classical music, a lot of world music at the time. And when I read that book, I think we were actually driving through this area. We were doing a tour through Mississippi and Louisiana. And it just hit me. I was like, it's all really coming from the same place. It's all folk music. And some of it has been around a lot longer. You know, this, at that point, you know, there's a few hundred years of music in the States where you have certain forms of traditional music in India that's been going on for 1500 years or who knows how long. And I mean, it's blues everywhere. It's people singing their lives and just kind of, you know,
telling a story.
Yeah. You tell a story. And the human condition is the same everywhere. And I think that's why, this music has, why it does appeal around the world. You know, we hit a lot of countries when we're touring, and there's a blues festival in almost every major country in the world. Yeah. It's pretty powerful.
From,
you know,
Norway to, yeah, Japan to Poland.
You know, we always say, you know, we're like, you know, B.B. King and those are American ambassadors. Like that's the ideals, and that's the stuff that actually flies everywhere. The Willie Nelsons of the world and the BBs and the people that are,
and Buddy Guy.
Yeah, I mean they're playing music and it wraps around the globe. It's pretty amazing.
What countries have been the most surprising places that you found blues fans?
For me, Poland and Macedonia, I think, are the two. It was a pretty overwhelming response. But then, you know what, you think about it.
Well, Holland, they have a huge blues festival, and they love everybody from T-Model Ford to, you know, as, you know, broken and, you know, and, yeah, and simple to the most eclectic type of musician. So it's interesting when you go, and they can't really speak your language, but they can totally understand what you're singing about. So that's very moving.
I mean, throughout Europe, there's a fascination with a lot of this music.
Japan,
but
sometimes
it's almost, I don't know, it's not a visceral thing. It's you think of it in some kind of outside way. But in Poland and Macedonia, it hit me that I was like, these are completely different places, but it's a very similar experience. Like Poland has been beat down for a long time, and they relate to music that came out of that situation, you know, and the same with Macedonia. I remember the woman that picked us up from the airport, who was our interpreter, more than probably a half dozen times, her just saying, "It's so hard being Macedonian." And I was thinking, that's why this music resonates here, because this is music that came from an extremely hard place and a hard time. And so I think it does speak on those levels too. There's some real bass elements at work.
I was thinking back to Mike Bloomfield was inducted last night into the Blues Hall of Fame, and you listen to East West, you hear some raga themes.
Yeah.
For me, the first time that I'd heard a blues musician do something like that, how did you come to incorporate some of these elements? I know you hear things and you pull them in, but how do you actually incorporate that in a way that produces a Grammy award-winning album? Because people have done that, but then, you know, they're sitting in a shelf in a library. You produce something people actually buy and listen to.
I mean, I think you have to have those musical epiphanies that are honest and real. And for me, it was actually traveling that same trip where I read the Robert Palmer book. I remember we kind of did our little blues pilgrimage. We hit a lot of the spots, and we stopped at the Crossroads Museum, and I picked up a Junior Kimbrell CD because I saw Robert Palmer's name on the back. He had produced it, and the writer Robert Palmer, not the performer. And I remember listening to this. I wasn't familiar with Junior Kimbrell. I didn't know anything about him. I put on the record, and the first song he sang, he just sang this line that reminded me of a Qawwali singer. It sounded Middle Eastern. It was microtonal. It was just, it kind of twisted my head for a minute. That's when it dawned on me. It was like, it's, you know, these are all the same elements. I mean, and the blues has that, and Junior did this as well as anybody, where he would really drone over, it would just be one tonic, and he would just kind of move in and out of it. And that's the thing with Indian classical a lot, and some of the Qawwali music, where
and jazz too.
Well, yeah, jazz is more harmonic and a lot of changes, but the junior Kimbrel and the Indian classical, it hit me that, you know, you can just have a tonal center and it's all melody and it's all feeling and it's all, you know, there are rules to each music, but and at a certain point they meet. So it was listening to Junior Kimbrel and Ali Akbar Khan on the same day for me that
wow.
in Nusrat, those three, and Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, the great Qawwali singer. So those were the three. And then I remember being in Memphis playing a gig a few days later after listening to that Junior Kimbrel record probably 30 times in a few days and reading the liner notes, and the liner notes, it talks about Junior Kimbrel's juke joint in Holly Springs. So I get out our Rand McNally map at the time, and I was like, wait a minute, that's like 30 miles from Memphis. So we had a day off. I got on the phone. I called information. Can I get Junior Kimbrel's juke joint? She gave me a number. I called it, and it was, I guess it's just his house. So Junior Kimbrel picks up, Junior here. I didn't know what to say. I told him, I was like, look, I'm just a big fan. I wanted to see if you were performing anytime soon. And he had said, he's like, I've been really sick. You know, I just got out of hospital in Memphis, and like, we were lifelong friends. He just kind of told me his last few months and the saga he'd been through. And I think he probably passed maybe 2-3 months later. So I never got to see him perform. I did get to speak with him. I bugged him at his house, unfortunately, but it was, it's something I won't forget. That's for sure.
If you had to name two or three people that you wish you could have played with before they passed, it may be different for each of you, who would you name?
Sue?
Oh, my goodness. That's not fair. Ray Charles. I guess I wish I could have got up there and did a duet with him. I got close. I did open a festival and got to sit on his lap. That's about as close as I got. Which was close enough. That was pretty amazing. Mahalia Jackson, but I don't know if that would really work, but that would be an amazing dream to sing gospel with her. And probably Muddy Waters. Probably love that. That would be really fun. Or Elmore James, maybe, because he was so full of life and his tone was awesome.
I'd go Mahalia too.
You would?
I think Mahalia would be a great one. Somebody that I almost had a chance to play with, we were actually talking about doing a record with him when he passed, was the great drummer Elvin Jones, who was on not all but most of the great John Coltrane records. Just extremely powerful player. We were going to do a quartet record with me and him and the Burbridge brothers, O'Teal and Kofi Burbridge. But he... Same thing. I right at the tail end of his life, he played right to the end though. But so I missed that chance. And you know, maybe Elmore James or Hop Wilson, one of the great slide players. Maybe Hop. That'd be even probably crazier in Houston ghetto blues.
How do you balance a family with all of this?
You know, we're really, really fortunate. I mean, it's still hard, and it's still, you know, even doing something like this, we don't get a lot of time off. So to leave for a few days, you really have to think about it, you know, because your kids don't want you to go. And when you are home, you want to devote all your energy. But, you know, we're really lucky. My brother and his wife live about 10 doors down the road. My parents are in the same city, and his mom moves in to our house when we're gone. So
it's amazing.
The old adage, it takes a village. We're fortunate that we actually live in that situation. So,
yeah.
That's the only way I think it's the only way we could do this, the band we have together.
I actually still don't know how we do it.
Yeah.
Because we get home and it's right back into parent mode. Like right now we're in the middle of two science fair projects, finals and, you know, playoffs and baseball, horse riding
shows.
Yeah,
it's a mile a minute.
I mean, there's so much going on. So we have a son and a daughter. And
sometimes the hardest thing is flipping the schedule, because when you're on the road, you play late, you get in the bus, you drive all night. Usually stay up with the band hanging. It's hard to go to sleep right after a show, or even 3 or 4 hours after a show. So you're up till not sun up, but close to it. And then you get home and it's
up at 6:30.
You got to get up, get the kids to school. It's that can be tough. Susan's better at it than I am.
I do. I don't.
I remain.
I just need
insomniac.
4 hours of sleep at night. If I get 4 to 6 hours, I'm good.
That's great. How you're at the Blues Foundation's Blues Music Awards with us this year. Time. Why is it important for people to be supporting the Blues Foundation now?
To keep the memory of a lot of these artists alive.
Absolutely.
And also to help bring awareness to how a lot of them are still alive, like people like Jody Williams, who I actually just realized is still around. He was, you know, original guitar player with Howlin' Wolf. And, you know, it's people like that that really are important to educate our kids about. You know, because they're really the treasures of America, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's definitely that side of it where there are living blues musicians that are keeping the real traditional music alive and real and honest, and mm-hmm. And they have very real world problems a lot of times.
Yeah.
You know,
so we need to help raise money.
So there's
or
that,
education
and there's also the I mean, for me, the whole concept of when the culture dies in a place, then the empire is not far behind. And I feel like blues and jazz are really our gifts to the world, culturally. I mean, there's a few others, but I think it's vitally important that people know where it came from. And I mean, you turn on the TV and you watch any of the other award ceremonies and there's just not a lot of substance to it. And when you come here and you look around the room and you're like, wow, there's actually musicians here and there's people that actually know about music and care about music, and it's a very real, yeah. It's a very real thing. So I think for that reason, it's important. And just, you know, just to give, and I know for a lot of musicians, we're fortunate. We've had a fortunate half dozen years or so where things are starting to roll, but I'm sure for a lot of musicians here it actually gives you hope that there's light at the end of the tunnel, you know.
Exactly.
So it's a great thing.
And the blues don't make a lot of money, you know, so it's really nice to have an award ceremony where you can pay tribute to these people,
yeah,
who work so hard
people for
and
doing
they do
the
it
good
because
work.
They love it. They don't do it for money. You know, I know there's a lot of kids out there that are like 17 years old making millions of dollars doing crappy pop music, but at the end of the day, you know, it's gonna come and go, you know, but this stuff is gonna stay and it's gonna add to our culture, like Derek said. And I think it's really important to support it, and it's an honor just to be part of it and to be, you know, a witness to it. And I know I was raised on it, Derek was raised on it, so we really are some of, you know, the younger generation that do appreciate it and love it and want to help spread the word about it.
Is it old people's music? Some people say that.
I don't think so. I mean, I think people can assume that, you know, maybe if they're not educated about it. But I know little kids that are 9 and 10 years old that play great blues. So I don't know.
I think with any music, it's you know, if it's real, it's going to last, and you got to help it along. Sometimes a lot of great stuff gets lost in the wash, unfortunately. But I don't think it's age specific at all. I mean, I think that's the beauty of even at Allman Brothers shows or our concerts. You look out and you see young teenagers, and you see guys that saw the original Fillmore concerts in 1970, and you see, you know, I mean, you see grandparents with their grandkids at shows, and you can't tell who's enjoying it more. You know, it's a pretty great thing. So real music has a way of getting through to people with open ears. And I'm a firm believer that if you play terrible music for the masses, they will accept it, and the bar will just be lower. But if you play real music for people, they'll accept that as well, and it does make things better. I mean, our kids are examples of that. They hear things through their friends, but they also hear the music in our house, and it's always a moment of pride when I hear my son listening to his iPod and it's Sly Stone or Stevie Wonder or B.B. King or something legit, and I'm like, are you listening to that on your own? He's like, yeah, I love this song. And so, you know, real music does get through to all ages. I mean, it was popular at one point for a reason, because it's, you know, it speaks to people.
Well, some of us are lucky. My daughter, who's with us, still has my original Hound Dog tape.
Nice.
And plays it. So,
House Rockers.
Yeah, fortunately, it does live on. You've got a new CD coming out very shortly.
Yep.
And that's culled from a number of live performances.
Yeah.
How did you decide what to put in it? You had such a wealth of material.
You know, we took a lot of the vintage recording gear out of our studio, and really we wanted to treat this live record like we would a studio record. We wanted to make sure the recordings were as good as we could get them. And, we had Jim Scott, the great engineer and producer, and Bobby Tees, who's amazing, and a few other guys that helped us that came out and really put a huge amount of time on the front end while we were recording and on the back end. And I'm really, really pumped with the way it turned out. We recorded 12 shows that way, so there's a lot to dig through. I mean, we spent a good 2.5-3 weeks digging through 20 something hours worth of music, but you know, as the tour went on, I was taking notes every night after the show if there was a great show or a great song, and just taking immediate after the gig notes. And then you get away from it for a week or two and you start remembering the nights that really rose above the others, and you kind of start there. And it came together pretty organically. I mean, we ended up using three shows, but a lot of times it would be 4 or 5 songs in a row that just naturally flowed together and worked. And but you know, we dug through it and spent as much time mixing this album as we would a studio record. So we wanted the sounds to be right. And when we got the mastered version back and the mastered vinyl back, it was a good feeling, because the sound is what I wanted to hear. You know, it's easy to turn out a live record these days and just kind of phone it in, and just, you know, and it's good. The performances are good, but the sound isn't great. When we got these back, because of Jim Scott and Bobby Tees, I don't know if I've heard a live record that sounds this good. I haven't heard one in a long time, so it's a good feeling.
What's next? What are you going to do?
Write another record.
Yep, that's right. Back in the studio, start writing.
Back in the studio. We're actually starting writing. I mean, we've already got a bunch of ideas started, but we're technically starting on Monday with Mike Madison, who is such a fabulous songwriter. He wrote Midnight in Harlem and with Derek and Bound for Glory. And he's, you know, just a really wonderful songwriter. And I think he really knows how to capture this band. And so Derek and I are going to sit and write with him on Monday and start writing this next record.
Is that how the collaborative process works for you generally?
Sit
down?
Yeah, usually we sit down.
Sometimes
and get started.
On the road, ideas happen at any time, but it really is. When you're on the road, there's the health and the self-preservation and making sure the gig is right, and with an 11-piece band, just coordinating everything, it's hard to be too introspective. So sometimes it takes being home, having time off, and just really focus on, you know, what do you want to say with this next record? What, you know, and sometimes it's taking a few days to just decompress and think about the last few years and, you know,
like what have we done?
Yeah, what
do we want to
just happened?
What are we trying to get across?
Yeah, so
who do we want to get across to?
So Monday will be a musical brainstorming.
Exactly.
And sometimes it's just hanging, having a few drinks, and spinning records. you know, you never know what's going to inspire you. So
any famous recordings that you'd like someday to do your own?
I mean, there's a ton. I mean, when we did this live record, there's Donny Hathaway live. There's live at the Fillmore East. There's records like that inspire you. Thinking about Levon Helm, and there's The Band, you know, music from Big Pink. Those are just classic records. I think those records inspired Revelator, our last record. I think that was kind of we wanted it to feel like a collective. We wanted it to be about the song, and you wanted everybody to contribute, but nobody overwhelm it and really have the song be the thing.
And intimate.
Yeah.
Not so much just what, you know, nowadays it feels like a lot of musicians are into, like, what riffs can you play and what can you do, instead of what about the music and how can you really get down to its purest form, we're talking.
Yeah, and
I think that's what we try to do on Revelator, is
absolutely
not be so showy, because we have some of the best musicians in the world in the band, and they could probably outplay everybody, but they don't, because they're trying to play for the music and for the song, and we're trying to listen to each other.
And sometimes you're thinking long, you're thinking I want to make a record that ages. I want to make
that people can,
you know, like a great wine. I want to make a record that sounds better 5-10 years from now, rather than have something that's just. I mean, sometimes immediate and in your face is great. Sometimes that lasts. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it goes pretty quickly. So this last record, we were trying to make a record that we thought would be around for a while, and we recorded it that way, and we made sure when we mixed it and when we mastered it, there's just this thing now where everybody mixes things as loud as possible and everything is just redlined, and you master things that are so loud so it sounds good on an iPod and it sounds good on all these crappy ways to hear music and then you're like, you know what, I want this thing to sound great anywhere, you know, and if you need to hear more of it, you can actually turn it up. so we went out of our way to think about this record that way. The next one I think will probably be a little more aggressive.
Do you find that you lose dynamic range in the recording process? A lot of these things are pumped up so much that you can't compete, they say.
Yeah.
Unless you do. What do you do to make sure that you don't
make it sound really good?
I think you just have to be completely stubborn about it, and you know that was the beauty of working with Jim Scott on this last record, is he's, you know, he makes records the old way, and we really fought it at every turn with a major label, and with, it's like, you know what, we're not going to mix this record loud. We're not going to overcompress it. Sorry. It's just not going
to
happen.
Yeah, and he makes modern records. I mean, he's made records for Tom Petty to, you know, whoever, the Dixie Chicks and Crowded House. So it's not like he's doing one type of music, you know, but he definitely knows what it's like to put something on radio and have people be able to hear it.
The end of the day, you have to make something that you're 100% behind, and I was really happy that he saw the band and what was going on for what it was, and he wanted it to be something that would last, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's certainly the way. I mean, when you build a studio and you put time and energy into capturing sounds, that's the way you want to do it. You don't want to shortchange it. So, you know, and it, at least me personally, Susan has had some luck on the radio. I never make music or think about music with radio in mind. My assumption is, you know what, we're just going to have to hit the road, and that's where it's going to work. And these are, you make records to document where you are at that time, and you make it, and you want it to sound as good as it can. So that's really the only bar I personally try to reach. And, you know, the beauty of, even though we have been with a major label for a while where you can get that pushback, having the studio and producing things yourself, at the end of the day, it is your call. so we're stubborn. It works
well,
in our favor.
It works out to be a good mix now, because he's stubborn and I honestly never really had a lot of say in the past. So now he has a lot of say, which is great. And that helps me, so I can have a little bit of say if I need to. And then also, you know, I have had a radio push, so it helps us get some radio. And I think it's a good combo. You know, the two of us are going towards the same goals. And I think this band is really a step up for both of us, because we get to be more creative. And we do have major label support, being able to play blues or folk music or whatever it is that we want to play, which
is an extraordinary accomplishment these days.
It is.
It's about impossible. You know what? It really is. I mean, just being around, being on Sony for 10 years, it's the end of the era. It's the game is up. So, I mean, it's, you watch it shifts. I mean, over this last decade, it's shifted so much. Every time I go back in that office, there's just less people there. It's really
a sad
scene. But my feeling is the whole business just painted itself into a corner. And it's like, you know, when you sign below average artists for that long, I mean, how long? It's like I don't really have a lot of sympathy. Some of my friends that work there, I do personally, but it's a, you know, it's like real artists are going to survive because they have real fans and they build a real fan base and they make real music, and that will never go away. Labels dying, that's not going to change that at all. You know, at least personally, I had a band. My group was together for 16 years. We made 7 records. I don't know if we ever made a dime off of a record. You tour, and that's what you do. So when all of that stuff shifts and everyone's freaking out, I think it sure is lucky that we don't care about that. Yeah. Like, it doesn't affect us at all. So,
well, technology is definitely caught up with everybody.
It has, but I think that the two of you both have respect for the people who came before, and you keep them alive by what you do. And I'm also impressed when I listen to the band. Usually, you can say, "Ah, this is the star," and they've got all this backup. But the band is the star.
It's true.
On your recordings, which really is impressive.
Great. Yeah, we're fortunate. I mean, when you're surrounded by musicians of that caliber, it's foolish not to to show it off at times. So, yeah, I mean, when we're on stage with this lineup, it's pretty. I mean, it's a daunting task to get up there and try to lead it all the time, because it's there's some amazing players up there, but when it all gets pointed in the right direction, it's a force for sure.
Fantastic. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to speak to us today. Wish you best of luck in the future.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Likewise.
So much.
You're listening to the Blues Radio International. You're listening to the Blues Radio International.
Blues Radio International uses the power of AM shortwave to broadcast to over 184 countries around the world. It is truly amazing what the power of the blues can do. Blues Radio International provides live blues to over 184 countries around the world, 24 hours a day. BluesRadioInternational.net is where you can find everything that we are up to. www.BluesRadioInternational.net. I'm Audrey Michelle for Blues Radio International.